In an in-depth analysis, we decide that we can pay $80,000 for the home. We offer this price and ask the seller to pay the majority of the closing costs. After some brief negotiation, they accept. Now, take a look at figure 2 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures, which is the breakdown on this property's numbers produced by the Bigger Pockets Rental Property Calculator. As you can see, with this property, we are planning to make approximately $370 per month in cash flow. At the end of the year, we may have to pay some taxes on this, so we're going to set aside about $70 a month for that purpose and use a clean $300 per month as our cash flow number on this property. Keep in mind, this is after all the expenses have been paid or set aside for, including property management, vacancy, repairs, maintenance, capital expenditures, taxes, insurance, and utilities. A person could theoretically have an extra $100 per month added to this cash flow by managing the property themselves, but I like to include management in here because we are still working a job while putting this plan in place. Therefore, we are now able to save $300 per month extra because of this property. Also, from this point forward, each year, we will add $100 per month in savings from our personal income because we get an annual raise from work and have decided to save a portion of this for our future as well. Therefore, during year 1, we've saved $1,000 per month. During year 2, we will be saving $1,100 per month. In year 3, we'll save $1,200 per month, and so on. So we add the $300 per month from the property to the now $1,100 we save from our income each month, which means we are now saving $1,400 per month for all of year 2. At the end of year 2, therefore, we have $18,800 saved, enough to purchase another property. Year 3. For simplicity, we will purchase a second rental property this year using the exact same numbers as we did the first time. In other words, we will spend $16,000 on the down payment and achieve, after all expenses have been paid, $300 per month in cash flow. We can now add that to the $300 we are saving from our first rental property and the $1,200 we are saving from our job for a total monthly savings of $1,800. At the end of year 3, then, we have $21,600 to use for another purchase. Year 4. Again, for simplicity, we will purchase a third rental property this year using the exact same numbers as we did for our first two. In other words, we will spend $16,000 on the down payment and achieve, after all expenses have been paid, $300 per month in cash flow. We can now add that to the $300 we are saving from our first rental property, the $300 we are saving from our second rental property, and the $1,300 we are saving from our job for a total monthly savings of $2,200 per month. At the end of year 4, therefore, we have now $26,400 to use for another purchase. Year 5. Once again, we will repeat this exact same process to buy a fourth rental property using the money we have saved as our down payment. Although the down payment is only $16,000, we have $26,400 to use, which means we have more cash to put into repairs, reserves, or any other costs. We'll purchase this property using the exact same numbers as we used for the others, and we will once again increase the amount of cash we are saving from our job. Therefore, at the end of year 5, we will be saving $2,600 per month and own 4 rental properties. Year 6 through 10. As you can see, we are following a very simple pattern here of buying one house per year and saving our income. However, starting in year 7, some interesting things start to happen. We are able to save so much money at this point that we can buy not one, but 2 rentals in year 7. By the end of year 6, we are now saving $1,500 per month from our job and $1,500 per month from the 5 rentals we now own for a total of $3,000 per month. This translates to $36,000 per year, enough for the down payment on 2 properties instead of just 1. This is when real estate starts to get really fun because we get to see the effects of compound interest kicking our investments into high gear. Check out the following graph, which I'll read to you, which shows this pattern of using total saved cash flow to buy rentals. In fact, every year after 7, we'll be able to increase the number of rental properties we can buy. We'll buy 2 properties in year 7, 2 in year 8, 3 in year 9, 4 in year 10, 5 in year 11. Let me read that graph to you. In year 6, we purchase 1 property. We own 5 properties. We're saving $1,500 a month from our job. We're saving $1,500 a month from our cash flow for a total amount saved of $3,000 per month or $36,000 for the year. In year 7, we purchased 2 properties and now we own 7 rentals. Our job savings is now $1,600 per month. We're now saving total cash flow of $2,100 per month. And so by the end of the year, we've saved up $44,400 from cash flow and job savings. In year 8, we purchased 2 properties. We now own 9 rentals for job savings of $1,700 per month and our total cash flow of $2,700 per month. We've now saved over that year, we're able to save $52,800 for the year. In year 9, we purchased 3 rental properties with that saved cash flow from year 8. We also own 12 rentals now in year 9. Our job, we're saving $1,800 per month, and the cash flow is now $3,600 per month. For a combined total savings for the year, we're saving $64,800. That allows us in year 10 to buy 4 rental properties, now making our total ownership to 16 properties. We're saving $1,900 per month from our job. Our cash flow, we're saving $4,800 a month. So by the end of the year, we're able to save up $80,400, which will allow us in year 11 to purchase 5 properties. And we now own 21 properties. We're now saving $2,000 a month from our job. Our total cash flow at this point is $6,300 a month. And that means our total by the end of the year, we're saving $99,600. Clearly, the total cash flow we are receiving each month is increasing very rapidly. In fact, after we purchased the 5 properties in year 11, we are receiving $6,300 per month in cash flow. Our goal, if you recall, was just to make an extra $5,000 per month, and we've already surpassed that. At this point, there's a few things we could do. We could continue working our day job and buying more properties. We could continue working our day job and begin paying off the properties. Or we could quit our job and become a full-time real estate investor. Or 4, we could retire and lay on a beach. Really, it's up to you. The exciting thing is that we achieved our goal, $5,000 per month in passive income from the rentals we owned. If this plan didn't seem cool enough as it is, keep in mind that this plan did not even take into consideration the fact that rental income tends to climb over time. So that $300 per month in cash flow from the first few properties would likely become much more, resulting in even greater total numbers. The plan also doesn't factor in the equity you would be building through the loan paydown or through appreciation. Again, this plan is a very simplified representation of what could happen if you choose to follow this particular rental strategy. Understand, however, that real life is never as neat and clean as it looks on paper or here in an audiobook. For example, consider the following scenarios. What if you got laid off from your job and couldn't buy for a year? What if you didn't get a raise at work? What happens when the banks stop lending? What if interest rates rise dramatically? These are all real-life situations that could happen to you along your plan, so don't freak out when they do. Life will never look as it does on paper, and that is okay. The point of a plan is not to map out exactly where you're headed, but to give you a North Star to follow. Now, let's look at one other plan, the house hack. How to hack your housing. The third plan I want to discuss in this chapter is the idea of the house hack. If you've been listening to the Bigger Pockets podcast for any length of time, you will have likely heard this phrase before. And I know that I hold a special place in my heart for this kind of strategy. House hacking is the idea of combining your investment properties with your personal residence. Although it is possible to do with just a single family house, such as by doing a live-in flip or renting out bedrooms, the phrase is more often used to describe the practice of buying a small multifamily property, like a duplex, a triplex, or a fourplex, live in one unit, and rent the other ones out. My first rental property was a small duplex that I bought for $89,000. The property needed some sweat equity, which my wife and I spent a few weeks doing, and then we rented the property out. Although we had stumbled across this house hacking strategy accidentally, we quickly realized the power of this method when the mortgage payment of approximately $630 per month was fully paid by the tenant in the other unit who was paying $650 for rent. In other words, the tenant was allowing my wife and I to live for free before operating expenses. House hacking has several distinct benefits that makes it especially terrific investment for first-time investors. First, a no or a low down payment financing. When you plan to live in a property for at least 1 year, financing becomes much more friendly for the borrower. For example, an FHA loan allows for just 3.5% down payment, and the USDA loan allows for $0 down if you are buying in a rural area. Traditional 20% down loans also work in this pricing structure and can do even more for your wealth building plans. On-the-job training. House hacking is a great introduction to the world of landlording. You buy the property and suddenly you're a landlord, so you'll learn very quickly what to do and what not to do. Close monitoring of your investments. When you live in the investment property, keeping an eye on the property and making sure it's running at peak performance is a lot easier. It's unlikely that the lawn will get overgrown, the tenants will move in a pit bull, or maintenance will go unreported for months. Saved expenses. Because you live at the property, you can manage the other tenants yourself very easily and don't have to worry about paying a property manager who will do substandard work. The following plan that you and I are about to walk through follows a serial house hacker. We'll purchase a house hacking strategy for numerous properties to reach our goal. In this case, let's set a goal of simply living for free so we can save money and pursue other investments in the future. The plan. To start the first year, we're going to buy a triplex. We'll start small because it's our first rental property, though we could start with a 3 or 4 unit property. Triplexes in this area, we'll say, run between $210,000 and $230,000, depending on the condition. However, we are smart shoppers and we can get a great deal on a foreclosure triplex for $180,000. And each side is going to rent for $950 per month. As before, pay more attention to the concepts here than the actual numbers. Every area, every location is different. To get this $180,000 mortgage, we'll put just 3.5% down through an FHA loan. After the purchase, we'll invest a few thousand dollars and in a few hundred hours making it look fantastic, like new paint, cleaning, etc. And at this point, if the property were 100% rented to tenants, it would bring in a total of $2,850 per month. But because we'll be living in one of the 3 units, we can expect approximately $1,900 per month in income. For expenses, we can expect a mortgage, including taxes and insurance and mortgage insurance, of approximately $1,200 per month. We also know that the water bill, which the landlord is responsible for paying here, runs roughly $130 per month. We'll set aside 5% of the rent of the $2,850 for vacancy, 5% for repairs, and 5% for future capital expenditures. CapEx is the big ticket items that need to be replaced every so often, like appliances, carpet, or new roof, which comes to about $142.50 each month, because $2,850 times 5% equals $142.50. At this point, our expenses look like this. A mortgage of $1,200 per month, utilities of $230 per month, vacancy of $142.50, repairs of $142.50, and capital expenditures of $142.50, making our total expenses $1,857.50. If you'll recall, our total monthly income on this property with the other 2 units rented was $1,900. So our cash flow is as follows. $1,900 in income, $1,857.50 in expenses. So our total cash flow is $42.50. Now, we are not only living for free, but we're also making a small sum of money each month for doing so. Notice that in the expenses we just listed, we did not include property management. I generally advise people to include property management in their analysis because they won't always be able to manage the property themselves. However, in the case of house hacking, including this figure is okay because you will not be living in one of the units forever either. Therefore, whenever you analyze a house hacking potential deal, you should analyze the deal 2 different ways, while in the process of house hacking and after you move out. After all, if the deal only makes sense because you're living there, then it really closes off your options for moving someday. You must buy with the end in mind, so let's run the numbers on the property as if you are no longer living there. To do this, I'll double the cost of the vacancy and repairs up to 10% each, and I will add in 11% for property management. Now, our total income is $2,850. Our total expenses are as follows. Mortgage, $1,200. Utilities, $230. Vacancy of 10%, $285. Repairs, $285. Capital expenditures, 5%, $142.50. Management, 11% of $285, making our total expenses $2,427.50. Therefore, because cash flow is total income minus total expenses, We can see that our income is $2,850. Our expenses are $2,427.50, making our total cash flow $422.50. As we've discovered, even after moving out of the property, we could reasonably expect to get around $422 a month in cash flow. For putting just 3.5% down, that sounds like a pretty great deal to me, huh? What do you think? How to make $100,000 per year using the BRRRR strategy. Some people work so hard to make money in real estate. They flip dozens of homes, deal with hundreds of tenants, and are always trying to put out a fire somewhere. Sounds exhausting, doesn't it? But what if I told you that within 5 years, you could be making $100,000 annually from just 2 real estate transactions per year? Sound too good to be true? Today, I want to teach you about the BRRRR strategy and the power it can have in your real estate investing. I'll also be walking you through a step-by-step plan for making $100,000 per year using this powerful investing plan. What is BRRRR? BRRRR, or B-R-R-R-R, is an acronym for a popular investing strategy that until now hadn't been given a name. So I decided to name it. BRRRR stands for Buy, Rehab, Rent, Refinance, Repeat. In other words, it is a strategy that involves buying fixer-upper rental properties, repairing them, renting them out to get great tenants, refinancing them to get your money back, and then repeating the process. This can be a powerful strategy because it allows you to acquire numerous properties without running out of capital to invest. Let's break the strategy down and look at each step. Buy. The first step in the process is to buy a great deal. Not just any deal, a great one. Great location, great neighborhood, but a fixer-upper house. BRRRR investing is very similar to house flipping. In fact, it is kind of house flipping, but rather than selling the house, you rent it out after fixing it up. But the same principles that go into house flipping are needed here. For example, a popular rule of thumb used by many house flippers is called the 70% rule. This rule of thumb states that the most a flipper should pay for a property is 70% of the after repair value, or ARV, which is what the house is worth when it's all fixed up, minus rehab costs. 70% of the ARV minus rehab costs. So a house that has an ARV of $150,000 and needs $30,000 worth of rehab could be purchased for $75,000 because $150,000 times 70% is $105,000. $105,000 minus $30,000 for repairs equals $75,000 purchase price. Think that's impossible to achieve? Just ask most successful house flippers and they'll tell you that their entire business model is built on similar margins. So stop saying I can't do it and start asking how can I do it? It may require direct mail, it may require Craigslist, it may require driving for dollars. It's going to take some hustle. But if house flippers can do it, so can you. And we'll talk about that later in this book, all those creative strategies you can use to find properties. Now, to finance this first property, you're not likely to be able to use a traditional lender. Most lenders are unwilling to loan the money on a fixer-upper. This means you'll probably have to look at options like hard money, private money, cash, home equity, and other strategies that we'll talk about later in this book, and I also outline in more depth in my previous book, The Book on Investing in Real Estate with No and Low Money Down. So if you haven't read that yet, start there. It'll change your life. Rehab. The next phrase in the BRRRR strategy is to fix the property up, rehab it. However, because the property will be rented out for a period of time rather than flip, the materials you use should reflect that reality. For example, I'm working on a BRRRR property right now. I just purchased it last week and I'm in the middle of the rehab part now. When my crew tore up the carpet, we discovered beautiful hardwood floors underneath. Although this seems great, I'm actually not going to refinish them yet. To refinish them would cost me around $3 a square foot or $3,000 total. Then when I go to sell the property someday, I'll probably have to refinish them again because of the heavy tenant usage. And that's if I can refinish them again. You can only refinish floors so many times before they're sanded too deep. So I'm going to use laminate flooring throughout the entire home. This will protect the original floors for around $2 a square foot and will look amazing. Then before I sell it someday, I'll just remove the laminate and finish the floors then and sell for top dollar. The key to rehabbing a BRRRR property is to make the property as tenant-proof as possible, using materials that will last a long time and won't need to be redone later. Also, rehabbing with the goal of getting the highest ARV, or after repair value, and rent possible is important. For example, if you can turn a two-bedroom home into a three-bedroom home, do it. This can add hundreds of dollars per month in cash flow and thousands in equity. Of course, you could do all the work yourself if you wanted, or you could hire it out. That is up to you and depends on your skill, availability, and desire. DIY can save you a lot of money, increasing the odds that you'll find a deal with numbers at work, but it will also take a lot of weekends and evenings. Rent. Next, it's time to rent the property out to great tenants. Luckily, you just bought a property located in a great location and rehabbed it to look brand new. Finding incredible tenants to rent the house shouldn't be too hard. Furthermore, because the property was rehabbed at the start, your repairs and capital expenditures like roof, siding, paint, etc., should all be fairly low for the next few years. Everything's already been fixed. Of course, you'll still need to budget for repairs and maintenance, but these should be much less than you thought. To rent the property out, you might choose to hire a property manager, but because you already rehabbed the property and are renting to high-class, great tenants, managing a BRRRR deal shouldn't be too difficult. I recommend saving the money and doing it yourself. I'm going to say something a little controversial now. The goal of BRRRR is not to make a ton of cash flow. I know, that goes against almost everything I've been preaching thus far. But I'm not saying to buy something that won't cash flow. Long-term negative cash flow is not acceptable ever. However, if I'm only making a little bit of cash flow, that might be okay with the BRRRR strategy because the power of the strategy is in the long-term flip, the equity built. I'll explain this more in a little bit. Earlier, I talked a little about how you were going to finance the property and mentioned that getting a conventional mortgage on the fixer-upper is tough. However, conventional mortgages are really, really nice. Low interest, long-term, easy. So the fourth step in the BRRRR strategy is to refinance into a nice conventional mortgage after the property has been fixed up. Even better, by refinancing, you have the possibility of getting all your money back. Of course, you don't need to refinance the property to get your money back. Perhaps you make great income from a job and you can afford to let your down payment or rehab money stay in the property. This will likely help you get better cash flow and maybe you'll get a better return on investment that you'd get elsewhere. However, if you're like me, you probably want your money back so you can do it again and again. So let's talk about how to do that. In other words, let's go back to those numbers we used earlier. We found that property that had an ARV of $150,000. We purchased it for $75,000 and we put $30,000 into the rehab. At this point, we have $105,000 into the purchase. Most lenders will allow you to refinance a property for 70% of the ARV. In other words, they will do a 70% loan-to-value, LTV, loan on the property. Well, it just so happens that 70% of $150,000 is $105,000. So we can theoretically get back 100% of our invested capital. That's right. We're going to refinance this property, get a new loan, with a new low-interest, 30-year fixed mortgage of $105,000. This will pay back whatever source of funds we used for the original purchase and the rehab. In this example, the only money out of pocket will be the closing costs. After the refinance, you should have a completely stabilized rental property that shoots off a little bit of cash flow each month and has roughly 30% equity just sitting there. Plus, you'll have all your money back, so it's time for the next step. Repeat. The final R in the BRRRR strategy is to repeat the process. It worked once and we got all our money back, so why not do it again and again and again? Sure, at some point the bank will stop refinancing the properties for you, and maybe you'll need to find another solution like a portfolio lender or a partnership, but it can be done. With each deal you repeat, you are gaining 30% equity at the end of the day and getting your cash back in your pocket. So how to make $100,000 per year with BRRRR? Now that we've covered the five steps of the BRRRR strategy, let's look at an example of how someone could make $100,000 per year using it. Historically, prices of real estate have climbed approximately 3% per year on average. Yes, some years are better and some year worse, but over time, this has been about true. For our example here, though, let's be a little more conservative and just assume 2% per year. Using this figure, let's say we bought a property today with an ARV, after repair value, of $150,000. But we paid just $75,000 for it and then rehabbed it with $30,000 and then refinanced it for $105,000. Then we rented the property out. At a 2% increase per year, the property could be worth $165,000 in 5 years. At the same time, the loan during those 5 years would have been paid down. So the balance would be just $96,500. In other words, after 5 years, we would have $69,000 in equity. Of course, if we went to sell the property, it would likely need another coat of paint and maybe some other minor fixes. Plus, we'd have to pay the real estate agent about 10 grand as commission. And then we'll pay a few thousand in closing costs. So that $69,000 in equity would look a lot more like $50,000 in profit at the end of the day. Therefore, to make $100,000 per year using the BRRRR strategy, you simply need to buy 2 deals each year and then begin selling 2 each year starting in year 5. As long as those numbers work, you'll never own more than 10 properties, and after 5 short years, you'll be making 6 figures just by doing 2 purchases and 2 sales every year. Now that could truly be a 4-hour work week. The biggest drawback of the BRRRR strategy. At this point, you're probably thinking, this sounds great, so what's the catch? As with all investments, you need to be aware of a few drawbacks. One that you may have already wondered about is, what if you can't refinance? If you are unable to refinance the property to get your money back, you are forced to kind of stop in your tracks. Therefore, I recommend visiting a few local banks and making sure you are a good enough borrower before you even purchase the BRRRR deal. Of course, if after the rehab you are unable to refinance the property, you could always wait until the first year lease is over with the tenant, kick them out, and sell the property. Having multiple exit strategies is always a great thing, and it's one of the perks of the BRRRR strategy. Other drawbacks exist well. What if the tenants destroy the house? What if you can't find a good enough deal? What if you can't finance the original purchase? These are legitimate questions, but the cool thing is this. There are answers. These are the kind of questions asked every day in the BiggerPockets forums. So if you're not engaging there, you're missing out on one of the most powerful tools you have at your disposal. Conclusion. The BRRRR strategy has many moving parts, but if you work it right, it can be a powerful ally in helping you build some serious wealth. Following the strategy can help you combine the equity growth of flipping with the tax benefits, cash flow, and appreciation of rental properties, maximizing your profit at the end of the day. Hopefully this chapter has helped you to outline a plan that you're going to take. If not, keep reading the book. You'll likely develop your plan as you go through it. But remember, a plan on paper is nothing if you don't take action. So it's time to get your butt in gear and do something. But before you do, understand that you can't always do it alone. Even Beethoven, Edison, and Babe Ruth had teams of people to help them achieve their goals. So now we need to start building your team.
Chapter 4, the 10 members of your real estate team. Michael Jordan once said, talent wins games, but teamwork and intelligence wins championships. Man, this is the closest I've ever been to dying. Although he uttered these words at the end of the 9th round, Muhammad Ali would go on to fight 5 more rounds against his rival, Joe Frazier, in that blistering hot October morning in 1975. With temperatures at an estimated 120 degrees inside the arena, 27,000 pairs of spectator eyes remained glued on the two fighters as Ali and Frazier danced around the ring, looking for the next blow that would disable the other man. Their faces bruised and swollen, and with sweat pouring into their eyes, each man landed punch after punch on the other without any sign of relenting. Associated Press boxing reporter Ed Schuler later said of the fight, "I'm sure I never saw a fight where two guys took as much punishment as those two did that day." Finally, just before the bell rang to start the 15th round, Frazier's coach ended the fight and Ali was declared winner of the Thrilla in Manila, which became one of the most talked about fights of all time. However, even though Ali's bruised face was the only one plastered all over the newspapers, he was not the only winner that day. Ali may have been named one of the greatest fighters of all time, but without his team, he would have never made it to that overheated arena in the Philippines. From his boxing coach Angela Dundee to his trainer, speechwriter Drew Bandini Brown, to his ringside physician, Ferdy Pacheco, to his corner man, Habir Herbert Muhammad, and many others, Ali used an entire entourage of individuals to secure victory time and time again. A solid team can help turn an average fighter into a world champion and can help turn you from a new investor into a successful real estate mogul. But what does team mean when we're talking about real estate? And how does one build this team? Your real estate team is a collection of people alongside whom you will work to make your real estate ambitions a reality. I'm not talking about hiring employees, though an employee could be considered part of your team. I'm referring to the professionals with whom you surround yourself with and who play an important role in finding, financing, and managing your rental portfolio. People get kind of weird about the term team, thinking of such groups as more formal than they probably need to be. A team is just made up of people you can depend on, and your teammates don't even need to know they're part of that team. You don't need a team name, a uniform, or matching socks. You just need reliable people. As with any sport, you are only as good as the members of your team, so work hard up front to build a solid team of professionals. In this chapter, I outline 10 different team members that you should begin building relationships with starting today. These are the teammates who will help you win your own Thrilla in Manila. Number one, your spouse. Perhaps the most important member of your team is your very own spouse or serious romantic partner. It doesn't even matter whether or not they care about real estate. Your spouse or significant other has a huge impact on your mental state, your ambitions, your free time, your money, your future, and every other aspect of your life. Your spouse will likely become your confidant, your sounding board, and your cheerleader as you get into this game of real estate. A spouse who is opposed to your mission can be a serious hindrance to you reaching your goals. So having your spouse on your team and not an outsider is imperative. But what happens if you reach the conclusion that real estate investing will be your ticket to financial freedom before your significant other does? In other words, what if your spouse doesn't support your real estate goals or dreams? This is one of the most common questions I'm asked on Bigger Pockets, and a problem nearly every real estate investor must overcome. Because honestly, it's unlikely that both people will fall in love with real estate at the exact same time. For those who have not yet been bitten by the real estate bug, real estate investing will likely appear no different than selling Amway, Tupperware, or one of the other 50 other money-making ideas that you've had in the past. So how do you convince your spouse that your motives are pure and that this time it's different? The following are 5 tips to help you do just that, based on the things I had to do at the beginning of my real estate journey. Focus on your education. The first way to show your significant other that you are serious about this business and to help them also see the light is by becoming an expert yourself. Be able to answer every question they might ask you. Learn everything you possibly can about what you want to do before trying to convince them to come along on your journey. Read tons of real estate books. Listen to a ton of podcasts and audiobooks. Hang out in the BP forums and attend local real estate networking events. Show your significant other that this is not just a fad in your life. This is your life. Next, start slow. When you begin to tell your significant other about real estate investing, you'll likely be very excited and want to share everything that you've learned. In your excitement and your zeal, you can very easily overwhelm your spouse with theories, facts, figures, concepts, math, and properties. Rather than convincing them, you'll just drive them further away as they see a huge, complicated world that requires far more effort to understand than they want to put forth. Instead, start slow and keep things simple. An easy-to-understand concept, such as the idea that passive income could replace a 9-to-5 job, might be easier to digest than the concept of the awesome wealth potential of a 1031 tax-deferred exchange, which we'll cover in Chapter 19. The Roman Colosseum wasn't built in a day, but was constructed brick by brick, from foundation to roof, in the same way you'll need to build your partner's knowledge brick by brick. Encourage them to learn. In addition, you can always encourage your partner to read or listen to the same educational material that got you hooked. When I first started, I remember asking my wife to read Rich Dad Poor Dad because it changed my thinking in such a profound way. I simply let Heather know how important this was for me and asked her to try it out. It took a bit of prodding, but eventually she did read the book and it helped put her on the same wavelength as me. Books have a unique ability to do this. Another great way to get your spouse to learn without them needing to work is by listening to a real estate podcast or an audiobook together in the car while driving somewhere. Sure, your partner might zone out, but audio has a way of penetrating the mind on both a conscious and subconscious level and transforming how a person thinks. Nearly every week, I get an email from a listener of the Bigger Pockets podcast telling me about how the podcast finally made things click for their significant other. And honestly, it can do the same for you. Share the why. We talked a lot about goal setting in Chapter 2, and one of the points I stressed was understanding the why behind your goal. Having a goal of making $1 million or retiring at 40 is great, but goals are rather useless without the why. The why guides you through difficult times and keeps you focused on the stuff that really matters. The same is true when trying to convince your spouse, so let them know the why. Which of the following sounds more convincing? A. honey, I want to invest in real estate so we can make millions. Or B, honey, I want to show up for every football game, school play, and musical recital our kids are ever in. With our current jobs, we miss out on so much. This is why I want to use real estate to build some passive income. Next, include them. Finally, find a way that your significant other can get involved if they want to. They don't need to know everything you know, but maybe they'd love to help out in one way or another to feel included and on your team. For example, my wife doesn't sit down and analyze every property with me, but she enjoys dealing with the books and keeping us organized, something that I do not excel at. In this way, she is able to provide incredible support to our vision, and we are able to work together to find even more success. Understand that your spouse does not need to participate with you in your real estate ambitions for you to succeed. However, it's helpful if your spouse is at least supportive of your goals and not fighting against you. Finally, and this is just my personal opinion, your marriage is worth far more than your wealth. I recently read a business book that advised readers to leave their spouse if their financial goals did not align. How tragic. To summarize a lesson from one of the most well-known people ever to walk this earth, named Jesus, what good is it to gain the entire world but forfeit your soul? Keep your ambitions in check on your journey to build financial freedom. Otherwise, you may gain the freedom you desire, but find it incredibly lonely at the top. Number two, your mentor or accountability partner. The next person you should have on your team is a mentor or accountability partner. This is a person you can turn to when things get tough or you need some motivation to continue. Of course, succeeding without a mentor or accountability partner is entirely possible, but having someone there you can talk to and who can help keep you moving in the right direction is exceptionally helpful when building a real estate empire. Now, when I say mentor, a lot of folks instantly think of a paid coach, someone who advertises their services for educational training. But this is not what I'm talking about. I'm referring to a real mentor, somebody who is in your local area, who also invests in real estate, and is willing to share their stories, their lessons, their failures, and their successes with you. For me, this person is Kyle. Kyle is my best friend's landlord, who I met while helping my friend paint a house. I just purchased my first rental property and was excited about the future of real estate in my life. So of course, I had a lot of questions for Kyle. How did he get started? Did he know any good contractors? How did he find good tenants? Where were the good or bad areas to buy? As we talked, Kyle could see that I was passionate and excited about real estate, which I believe helped encourage him as well. We ended up having coffee on several occasions over the next few months, and I soaked up as much info as I could. I also started doing small maintenance tasks for him, cleaning properties after a tenant vacated, dropping off legal notices for tenants, picking up supplies for construction projects, screening potential tenants for him, showing units when he couldn't, watching over his properties while he was on vacation, and whatever else I could do to provide value in the relationship. Through my developing friendship with Kyle, I was able to learn an extensive amount about the local market, attract private lending from somebody he knew, and get introduced to a great lawyer I still use today. We even worked together on a number of projects. Kyle has been hugely influential in my success thus far and has become one of my best friends in the process. So do you see the value in having this person on your team? So how do you find this person? It's not necessarily easy, but it isn't as hard as you might think. With 28 million real estate investors in America and only 43,000 zip codes, that works out to an average of 651 real estate investors within a 60-minute drive of where you live. You only need to find one or two who will work. Sometimes, new investors get a little weird about finding a mentor and end up approaching their potential mentor in a manner similar to how I asked my high school crush to the prom. Please don't approach an experienced person and ask, "Will you be my mentor?" Doing so is like asking a person to marry you on your first date, which I didn't do. But as I explained earlier, you're not forming some exclusive club here. You are building relationships, and relationships happen organically, yet purposefully. Here's a few ways you can find local investors with whom to build relationships. First, position yourself where landlords hang out. If you have a local real estate club or landlord association, I recommend attending their meetings and striking up conversations with as many folks as you can. Be wary of anyone who is selling any kind of mentorship or product, because you want to find real-life landlords to develop relationships with, and local ones especially. Ask your family and friends who are renting, who is their landlord? Does that person have a lot of properties? What are they like? Can they introduce you to them? As I mentioned earlier, this is exactly how I find my mentor, Kyle. Next, ask a real estate agent. Great real estate agents love to be connectors of people. As a result, if you want to find a prolific landlord in your area, simply ask an experienced real estate agent if they would introduce you to some of the local players. Next, hang out on Bigger Pockets. And finally, remember that millions of landlords come through the halls of BP every year, and many spend a good amount of time on the forums. I encourage you to consider Bigger Pockets as a whole, your digital mentor as you embark on your real estate journey. You see, a mentor provides real-time feedback, tips, stories, and a willing ear to listen. And this is exactly what you'll find on Bigger Pockets. Seek to become an enthusiastic learner that mentors love to help and do so every day throughout the forums and other areas of the site. Ask questions, send colleague requests, and form solid, lifelong relationships with those in the community. Now, how do you get this person to become your mentor? Let me ask you this. Who is the most recent friend you've made in your life? When you met this person the first time, did you walk up to them and said, "Will you be my friend?" Of course not. You develop that friendship via numerous conversations and encounters. The same thing applies when building a mentorship. I once had a Bigger Pockets member ask me to be their mentor, mistake number one, and then ask that I drive 2 hours to go talk to him since he didn't want to drive to my town, mistake number two. Do you think I ended up working with this person? Not a chance. Another friend of mine, a former Bigger Pockets podcast guest, recently received an email from someone that stated, "I've selected you to be my mentor. When can we meet?" No, no, no. Come on, people. Use some common sense when looking for a mentor. Once you meet someone with whom you'd like to build a relationship, rather than uncomfortably asking that person to commit to being your mentor, why not just ask them to grab a cup of coffee or grab some lunch? Or ask if they'll show you their most recent rental properties. Or offer to help fix up a unit for free. Or ask them what kind of property they're looking for and then go out and find it for them. The point is this. Build a relationship by offering value. Give more than you get. Offer more than you ask. Be a friend first and a real estate entrepreneur second. By following these simple steps, you'll build some lifelong relationships that will help you achieve your real estate goals. Number three, your real estate agent. The next member you must find for your team is a great real estate agent. Even if you plan to use other, more unconventional methods to find your deals, having a solid working relationship with a real estate agent as you build your rental portfolio is still very good. A great real estate agent can help you better understand the real estate market, including which areas and property types are selling or renting well. A great agent can help you find comparable sales data, also known as comps, so you can know the value of any property you go look at. A good agent can also help you bid on HUD, or the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD properties, bank repos, and other properties that are listed on the MLS, the Multiple Listing Service, which we'll talk about in other chapters, as well as set you up with automatic alerts so you'll be notified the moment a new property that matches your qualifications hit the MLS. So how much does a real estate agent cost you? Well, if you're looking to use them to buy property, nothing. In a typical transaction, the real estate agent is paid by the seller, which means using an agent will be free for you. For this reason, working with an agent is a no-brainer when you're looking for properties to buy. However, when you go to sell a property, you will need to decide whether using an agent is the right thing to do, but it probably is, and factor in the 6% or so that a seller must pay. Now keep in mind, a real estate agent is used to buy property that is listed on the MLS, not for unlisted properties. In other words, if you see a for sale by owner sign in front of a house, an agent may not get paid for helping you buy that house, unless the owner agrees to offer a commission, which they likely won't, hence the for sale by owner sign. If you find a deal through direct mail or another unconventional method, which we'll talk about later in this book, you are most likely on your own for the offer, the negotiation, and the closing. But don't worry so much. After finishing this book, you'll see that this is not such a tough process on your own. So again, a real estate agent is an important person to have on your team, whether you buy on the MLS or not. But the level at which you use them will depend on how you plan to acquire properties. Notice that throughout this section, I've used the phrase great real estate agent numerous times. This is because all real estate agents are not created equal. In fact, I would go as far as to say most real estate agents are pretty terrible with regards to helping investors. If you are going to build a relationship with an agent, don't you think it would be wise to build one with an agent in the top tier? Me too. So, what makes a great agent? First, they understand the investor mindset. A great agent understands that a cute kitchen and a pretty tile design on the bathroom floor are not your primary concern. If that is all your agent seems to talk about, run the other direction. You need an agent who understands the real estate investor's mindset and can help you achieve your goals, not theirs. They should understand the basics of return on investment, appreciation, making lowball offers, dealing with foreclosures, and what properties are currently renting for. You can find this out when interviewing your agent. Responsive. Real estate is becoming an increasingly fast-paced profession, and speed is often the number one determinant in getting a deal accepted. You, therefore, need an agent who is highly responsive and accessible through multiple means of communication. You should be able to reach out to them whenever you need to. I'm not saying the agent needs to work 24/7 for you, but if your agent shuts off their phone at 5 p.m. and avoids all calls on the weekends, you probably need to find another agent who is willing to be available when you are. Third, hungry. You need an agent who is ambitious and whose livelihood depends heavily on getting another deal. If they don't work, they don't eat. I've worked with agents in the past who have been in the game so long that they hardly have to work to make their commission. The leads just casually come to them and they casually work through the process. In other words, they aren't hungry. Avoid these agents and focus on the ones who are dedicated to finding you a great deal because they need to. Next, they have a pulse on the local market. Your agent should have a firm grasp on the current state of your local market. If there is a new Walmart going in, they should know about it. If there are zoning changes being discussed at the local city council, your agent should be aware of the proceedings. They should know where prices are rising, where they're falling, what areas are being revitalized, and what areas are turning into a ghetto. Tech savvy. This should almost go without saying, but I'll say it anyway. Your agent should be exceptionally tech savvy. They should know how to submit offers electronically to gain a competitive advantage over slower, older agents. They should allow you to sign documents via computer rather than with a pen. They should be able to use their smartphone on the fly to look up data about a property while visiting it. Although most agents today have a good grasp on technology, many are still stuck in the old ways and as a result are being left behind. Next, they have investment experience. Although this is not a make or break characteristic, partnering with an agent who has a personal real estate experience or background is helpful. After all, truly understanding the mind of an investor is hard if they haven't been there and done that themselves. Offers one-on-one support. Some agents are so good at what they do that they have an entire team underneath them that give them the support, in which case you may never actually talk to the agent directly, just to their assistants. In my personal opinion, I would avoid these kind of situations when possible. You want to build a relationship with an agent, not with some big shot who will barely give you the time of day. Well connected. A great agent should know people and be willing to connect you with them. If you need a contractor, they should have some good ideas about who to call first. If you need a lender, they should have some personal favorites to recommend. If you are looking to connect with other local investors, they shouldn't keep their address book closed. Honesty and displays integrity. Finally, working with an agent who has a reputation for being honest and true is imperative. There are many dishonest salespeople out there whose only goal is to get a paycheck. These are the kind of agents who will encourage you to buy a bad deal just because it's good for them. An agent with integrity is one who puts your needs above their own and understands that a slow dime is better than a fast nickel. Now, here are three good ways I recommend how to find a good agent. Number one, referrals. Number two, referrals. And number three, you guessed it, referrals. Don't hire an agent just because you saw their name on a park bench. Don't hire an agent just because your sister's boyfriend's parent's nephew is an agent, or even if your own mom is an agent. Get referrals from others and find out who the best agents in your town are. Now, one great way to do that is by using the BiggerPockets forums and asking other people, or by using other member search tools at biggerpockets.com/meet to find agents in your area. Finally, once you have the names of a few agents in your area, it's important to interview them carefully to make sure you are a good fit. Yes, I recommend actually sitting down at an appointment with them to talk. You'll be able to share your plans with them and ask them a series of questions to help you discover what kind of agent they are. This meeting is also when your agent will size you up and decide whether they want to work with you as well. In reality, most agents don't like working with investors, especially new ones. Most agents have been burned by wannabe investors in the past, people who talk a big game, but in the end, were just another flash in the pan fresh out of some guru boot camp. When agents think of investors, they often think big waste of time. But this is your chance to prove that wrong by being prepared and having a solid plan in place for what you're looking for and how you plan to fund your deals. Finally, I want to end this section with a warning. No matter how good an agent is, the buck always stops with you. Never rely on an agent to make decisions for you. Even the best agent tends to be highly optimistic about properties, and your job is to trust but verify. Look at the data your agent provides and make your own decisions about the property, the location, or the market trends. An agent is one of the most valuable members of your real estate team, but they are not a substitute for poor planning or a shortcut to easy deals. Should you get your real estate license? A real estate license is not required to invest in real estate, of course, but many investors choose to get their license anyway. Should you? Let's take a look at the pros and cons of getting your license to help you determine whether this is the right path for you. Pros. First, direct access to the MLS. Perhaps the number one reason investors get their real estate license is to gain unlimited access to the MLS, so they no longer need to access all the listings through an agent. As I've mentioned numerous times in this book, speed is key when trying to get a good deal in today's market, and being an agent can help you do it faster because you have access to the MLS, or the multiple listing service, which is where all other agents list their properties. Property access. Having your real estate license gives you the ability to check out almost any home without needing another agent to open the door for you. This can make the property searching process much easier because you don't need to bend to anyone else's schedule. Real estate relationships. Being an agent can help you build relationships with other agents, as well as lenders, appraisers, title companies, and others in your local real estate industry. Next, control the deal. When you have your license, there is no third party between you and the deal. Whether you are buying or selling, you are able to make decisions and control what happens to a much greater degree than when using an external agent. Commissions on your deals. Being an agent can help you make or save money on your own deals. When you buy a home listed on the MLS, the commission is usually split 50-50 between the agent who brings the buyer and the agent who listed the deal. Both sides usually paid by the seller. Therefore, when you buy a property yourself and you have a license, then you get to keep part of this 50% split for yourself or use it towards your down payment or closing costs. Your managing broker, with whom you will need to work with for the first few years, will also get a chunk of your 50% commission, though. It's not all yours. When you sell, you can either keep that money or use it as part of your negotiation strategy and maybe even give it to the buyer. The last pro I want to talk about is the commissions when you work for others. Finally, once you have your license, you'll be able to help other individuals buy or sell properties, and you'll earn a commission each time that they do. This can put a lot of extra money in your pocket, which you can then plow back into your investment strategy. You might even decide that being an agent is better than your current job and decide to quit. Cons. Costs. Getting your license is not free. You'll likely need to spend between $2,000 and $3,000 up front to get your license, plus several thousand dollars per year after that to hold on to it. Of course, if you are making or saving more money than this by becoming an agent, it's not really an issue. Education. Becoming a real estate agent is not as easy as filling out a form. You must attend a significant amount of educational classes before you can get your license and take a test. In Washington State, where I live, the class is 90 hours long. That's more than 2 full weeks. Although you can take it home and do it on your computer, it's not always a quick thing no matter how you do it. Disclosures. As an agent, you will need to disclose that you have your license on all the paperwork, including direct mail, when dealing with motivated sellers. It's unlikely that this would be a problem, and in fact, it could help bolster credibility. But sometimes people just don't want to work with an agent. To be honest, I think this is a very minor issue and probably not much of an issue at all. Next, paperwork. An agent has a lot of paperwork to manage, which can add a degree of administrative hassle to the mix. I enjoy the fact that my agent handles everything for me, and I just need to sign the occasional document. Finally, I am a strong believer in focusing on what you can do best and letting others do what they do best. This is the primary reason I don't have my license. My agent is the best agent in town, so why would I want to compete with him? I'll let him do what he does best, and I'll keep doing what I do best. So should you get your license? The truth is, it probably wouldn't hurt. I've chosen not to have mine currently, but there are many days that I wish I did. There's no universal right or wrong answer here, just a best for you answer that only you can know. You can succeed with a license, and you can succeed without one. Number 4. Lenders. Unless you plan to pay all cash for your next property, you will likely need to build a relationship with a lender or lenders so you can get your deal funded. Although I dedicate an entire chapter of this book to the world of real estate financing, I think touching on the lender here is important because they are part of your team and a valuable member at that. Lenders come in all shapes and sizes. For example, you could work with any of the following: a large national bank, a small community bank or credit union, a mortgage broker who helps you find financing from numerous different lenders, a mortgage company, a private or hard money lender with whom you build a relationship. As you continue reading the rest of this book, you'll begin to understand which of these 5 you should begin your journey with, but it doesn't hurt to start building relationships with all of them right now. Whether you plan to start investing this week or not for 3 more years, start having conversations with bankers today. Find out what the requirements are. Ask them what kind of loan programs they have. Maybe even send them a Christmas card. The truth about lending is this: almost every lender can do pretty much the same thing. Loan programs don't differ that much from one lender to the next, but what does differ is the skill of the person behind the counter, typically the loan officer or the banker. When I used to work as a loan officer, I would close significantly more loans than others in the bank. Not because I was getting more leads, but because I was able to work those leads through the arduous process to have them come out the other side. It's important that you find a lender who is ambitious, creative, and hardworking. If you wait to add this person to your team until you have a deal, you are taking a risk that you'll end up with one of the bad ones, and you might even lose the deal. Number 5, contractors or handyman. 2 weeks ago, I called 6 different contractors to come look at a small repair job on my personal house. Every single call went to an answer machine or voicemail. Okay, understandable, I thought. They're busy working, so I'll leave a message. In total, 4 of them called me back, and I scheduled 4 different appointments to get estimates. Of the 4 contractors with whom I had arranged appointments, 2 never even showed up. Of the remaining 2, 1 said he didn't know how to do the job, and the other said he would call me back with an estimate in 24 hours. Been a week, and now his phone is disconnected, and I still need that repair job done. For anyone who ever tried to hire a contractor or handyman for their home or business, this story probably sounds a bit familiar. It is really difficult. Among the more than 100 guests we've had on the Bigger Pockets podcast, I would rate finding a contractor as the number 1 difficulty mentioned. So why is it so tough? Well, I see 2 primary reasons. Number 1, contractors are not generally good business owners. This problem is part of the e-myth mentality, which dictates that just because someone can bake, it doesn't mean they can run a bakery. Just because someone can swing a hammer, doesn't mean they can answer phone calls or show up on time. And 2, real estate investors are always looking for a good deal now, which means we don't typically call the big guys, those who are good at running their business, because we know they'll be too expensive, are probably too big for small maintenance jobs, and will likely already be booked for the next 3 months. So what should an investor do? How can you add a good contractor or handyman to your team? Finding an incredible contractor or handyman. Number 1, be proactive, not reactive. Have you ever heard the old phrase, "The best time to look for a job is when you don't need one"? The same principle applies to contractors. If you are reactive in your search for a contractor, only waiting until something happens and you need to react to a situation, you are setting yourself up for problems. Instead, be proactive. Finding good contractors is a lifestyle, not a one-time event. Have a continually evolving list of people you could call on for various problems, and continue to add people to this list, even when you don't need someone at the moment. I ask nearly every person I meet in public if they have a good contractor, because I know that the success of my business hinges on the people I hire to take care of problems. The same will likely be true for your business. So be proactive and start looking for a great contractor today. Number 2, understand price versus cost. When you buy something, Are you buying based on price or cost? Confused? I was too, but several days ago I read something from the late Zig Ziglar in which he discussed the difference between price and cost, and suddenly I realized a huge error I'd been making in my investing business for the past decade. I've been hiring contractors based on price,